Okay, sweet spotters, I don't know if you're ready for this because you are in for a treat and a fascinating story.
Athletic excellence, yes. Strong families, wealth, but also depression, opioid addiction, and so much more. The biggest part is even through all of that, you can still find your sweet spot in Christ.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the sweet spot. Now, you probably wonder, what is the sweet spot?
The sweet spot.
Sweet spot.
Sweet spot.
What is the sweet spot?
Our guest today is Trish Porter Top Miller, who is a 1988 U.S. Olympian. Okay.
Wow.
Exactly. And she's multiple times U.S. National and World Masters champion. She also serves as New Mexico's Olympians and Paralympians president. I'm so excited to welcome Trish Porter Top Miller to the sweet spot.
Thank you so much, Mike and Diane. I'm so excited to be here.
Your voice says it all, and it speaks to all the things that you've been able to do and accomplish. Yeah. So can we start by talking about you as a young athlete? Were you in the sports all the time? Was it something that your dad pushed, something that your mom pushed? How did you get into sport?
I did. I think I drove my parents crazy because I was hyperactive and dyslexic when I was young. And so friends said, get her in sports. So that's what they did. So I did gymnastics. I was first girl in Little League Baseball in Northern California. And I did swimming. So it was anything to get out that energy.
Wow. So how was it when you were the first girl playing in Little League Baseball? What was that like?
You know what? It was really fun, except for I was really made fun of. So the boys all teased me. They made fun of me. They called me a boy. They said, you know, different names and the girls. And so I wasn't very popular, to be honest. But I really excelled and I did well and I played in the majors and I started and I had a good hitting record. So I had a lot of success and felt good about what I was doing, even though within my friends and peer groups, there was a lot of pressure.
At what point did you sort of, okay, stop this and you didn't play baseball? Was it a decision that you made and why did you make that decision?
I think I pretty much kind of aged out of the Major League Baseball and started then. I began my high school career, but really in eighth grade, I had a PE teacher. We were practicing the high jump. We were learning the high jump and I was terrible. I would take off of both feet. I would smash into the bar, into the high jump pit. And my PE teacher said, don't ever become a high jumper because you'll never be any good.
Oh,
I know. Wow. I know. And then in high school, I stove on the diving team and I played soccer. I was the goalie. And then I decided to run track and I started high jumping. And I had a coach who kind of saw some potential in me and spent some extra time and coached me.
Wow, unbelievable. And they said you would never become a high jumper.
Don't ever become a high jumper. I know. So what? Some people use those words and what do I want to say? They take them in and they let it destroy them, right? I chose to do the opposite. I'm like, okay, you can't tell me, you know, not to do something. And I use them to fuel me and motivate me in a positive way.
Now, growing up, Trish, your siblings... Were all of your siblings athletes? Did they come up, you know, doing sports as well?
So I had two younger brothers, Chuck and Mike, and they were also very athletic. And the thing was, I was older, but I was a girl, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to keep up with them. So they fueled me, right? They played football and we played football in the streets and we all played together and we played baseball and we did it together. And so I was very competitive and wanted to beat them all the time, and which I'm sure was very annoying for them. But they inspired me. They were, I think, some of the fuel on why I did so well.
Wow. Now, that competitive spirit and you being an athlete, your brothers being athletes, were your parents athletes as well?
They were. So my dad was a gymnast in high school. He was state champion for Illinois.
Wow.
And then I know it's kind of a big deal. And yeah. Then he went on to Dartmouth, and they did not have a gymnastics team there. They only had a club team. So he did club, but he would win a competition with just himself as the only competitor for Dartmouth. Wow. Yeah. So he was very athletic and did, snow skied and water skied and played tennis. And then my mom also, you know, in my mom's generation, there really wasn't competitive girls sports then, right? It really kind of began with my generation. But she was, kind of did some swimming and she played tennis and she snow skied. So she was very athletic herself and really enjoyed sports and being outside.
That's amazing. I know growing up, I didn't realize and I didn't know that my mom was a pretty phenomenal athlete until I got older. And I was like, well, what happened to me? Because I wasn't much of an athlete, but she was a phenomenal basketball player. And we're just, you know, my relatives have been pulling out old articles of, you know, this phenomenal woman who was a fantastic athlete that we had no idea she was an athlete. So that's pretty cool.
Wow. Yeah, that is wonderful.
We just knew her as the nicest woman in the world, right? And I'm saying that about an in-law, right?
Yes, good for you.
So she was just the best.
You're a smart man. She must be a good cook.
she's a great cook, but she's a better human being.
Oh, wow. You are very blessed and fortunate.
Yes. That's great. Now, I have to ask this. When you went on to sort of make the Olympic team, right? At this point, did you think that this was going to sport was going to be a lifelong thing? Was this your passion? Because now you're president in two different states, mm-hmm. right?
I'm just president in New Mexico.
I'm sorry. I've made you president in two states. I'm sorry.
I know. I like that. Yeah, okay. And I like the sound right now. Somebody just entered in. They think I'm president.
Yes.
Sorry, I couldn't kind of resist. That's
awesome. That's awesome.
So I went on to college and competed for the University of Oregon, which was the number one team the nation. And unfortunately, I gained more than that freshman 15 pounds. And so I did not do very well high jumping in college. But then in 1984, I was watching the Olympics on TV and I decided then that I wanted to train. And I wanted to train in the heptathlon, which is seven events in track and field.
Yes.
And so really it was post-college that I had started my career.
Okay.
And then after a couple years, yes, I excelled and did Team USA and got to compete in Canada, both Saskatchewan and Toronto. So that was super exciting for me. So I have Canada in my heart. Wow. And then I made the Olympic team when I was 26. So I was older.
Wow.
And no one expected me to make the Olympic team. So I wasn't on any anybody's what we call dope sheet. I wasn't planned. No one knew who I was, really. So that was very fun. And I'm very thankful and grateful that, and to me, that's it's how I know that there's a God. If someone like myself could make the Olympic team.
That's pretty impressive, actually, to make the team at the age of 26, when there's so many young people out there competing.
And yes. And I didn't do it in the heptathlon. I made it in the high jump.
In the high
jump. So that was kind of the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
More impressive.
That's that exclamation point to the grade A PE teacher, right?
I think it's called a mic drop.
So that's the world record when you were the 40 to 44. That's the world record, the mic drop, right?
That's right.
The mic drop. So then what happened is then I took 11 years off after the Olympics. I took 11 years off, had my two children, Connor and Shannon.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I had a friend call me and say, hey, do you want to meet me in Eugene, Oregon, which was my alma mater, and compete at the U.S. Masters National Championships in the high jump?
Wow.
And I was kind of intrigued by that. I'm like, And then I had a friend call and say, well, do you know what the world record is for age 40 to 44? It's 5'7". And I thought, oh, wow, I could do that. And he's like, you can do that. So I ended up there at Eugene meeting her, and I broke the world record. And then I broke the world record four times and jumped 5'9 1/4, which was as high as what I did in high school and better than what I did in college.
And this is after two babies.
That's after two babies.
Okay, now you can drop the mic.
Your life hasn't always, all of this hasn't been all smooth and roses. There have been some explosive moments. And can you maybe talk to us a little bit about your husband and your son, and maybe just walk us through some of the more challenging things in your life.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so at the Olympics, I met my husband, Pat Porter, who was a 2-time Olympian in the 10,000 meters and 8-time U.S. national cross country champion.
A gifted family.
I know. It puts a lot of pressure on the kids, actually.
I can imagine.
Yeah. I gotta feel sorry for them. But my daughter's, so my son was a fencer, and my daughter is a figure skater. And we had been driving back and forth between Albuquerque and Colorado Springs. We've been getting coaching in Colorado Springs for several years. And we were on our way home. The Olympics were starting the next day, and I had interviews planned for both TV and radio, because I often do that during the Olympics as an Olympian. And so I was on the way home, and I got a phone call, and I looked at my phone, and it was Channel 13, the TV station from Albuquerque. And I thought, oh, wow, it's kind of going to be a busy couple days. How fun. And then I answer the phone, and there I hear a woman say, can you please confirm that your husband, Pat Porter's plane went down in Sedona, Arizona?
Oh, wow.
And at that moment, you know, my world was rocked. And I what do I do? What do I do? I had think. How do I think? I couldn't think. I was crying, and I pulled the car over, and I got in the back of the car with my daughter, Shannon, who was 11. Mm-hmm. And we prayed. We prayed that they'd be alive. But I knew that they weren't. And so on July 26, 2012, it was true that my husband of 20 years, my beautiful 15-year-old son, Connor, who had just medaled at the U.S. Fencing National Championships, who had just the biggest smile and just loved life and the Lord. And then my son Connor's friend, Connor Manch, also passed away in a small plane crash. And my husband was the pilot. So that day I lost half my family. I lost my guys, both my guys, and our laughter. They were our laughter. And that was my life changed.
Now, if I could backtrack just for a second, I know you said when you received the news that you climbed in the back seat with your daughter Shannon and you began to pray, and you said your smile was taken away. I can clearly remember when my dad was taken, and how it was like you felt like you lost everything, right? You felt like you lost, felt abandoned, alone. All those feelings come over you. But what got me was you said you prayed. Now, were you always a Christian? Were you, because most people wouldn't just say, you know, just start praying, right? Because there's so many emotions, right?
There are. I didn't know what else to do. So I prayed. And I think that's when the rubber meets the road, is when we go through difficult times. Mm-hmm. We have a choice. How are we going to respond? Are we going to respond and draw closer to God? Or are we going to put up walls? So the answer is no, I was not always a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I was not raised in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't go to church much at all growing up. I accepted the Lord right before college. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to go to college. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was kind of at a crossroads in my life. And I went to spend some time with my aunt and uncle. mm-hmm. In a little cabin with a river running. And that night when I was sleeping outside on the little couch, I just said, God, I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. Help me.
Right.
And the next day, my aunt and uncle were bold and they were talking to me about Jesus. And they mm-hmm. finally said, you know, do you want to pray and ask Jesus to come into your life and to forgive you of your sins and to take over? And I was kind of like, well, I did that last night, but yes, I want to do mm-hmm. that. And so that was really the change for me, was in college, but that was, you know, a long time before this.
Right.
But I really, when the rubber meets the road in difficult mm-hmm. times, is how do we respond? And I was thankful and grateful that I did pray. It was the only right. thing I could think of doing, because I couldn't think at that moment. I couldn't think. I didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Totally understand that.
Wow. You mentioned that you gave your life to Christ just before going to university. How was that? Like, in university, did you have mentors? Did you have people there to guide you? Or what was the beginning of your walk like?
Yeah, so I am really grateful, because I literally was launched and just went to college where, you know, as everybody talks about, so many, 85% of all kids walk away from their faith in college. I got plugged into the group Navigators at the time. And then ultimately FCA, Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Mm-hmm. And then I had a really wonderful church with a pastor who turns out, interesting enough, was a distance runner, Jeff Wells, and placed, I think, second at the Boston Marathon. And his wife, they really took me under their wing and mentored me. And so that was the difference for me, is having these experienced Christians come alongside me and help me and do Bible study with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really grateful for that experience.
Now, your daughter, Shannon, when yeah. all of this happened, how did it affect her?
You know, it's so hard, because as I was trying to function myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I was very aware of her too, in some sense. But I want to say that first night I slept with her for several nights. Mm-hmm. That first night in bed, it was in the middle of the night and we were talking, and she said, Mom, I know they're in heaven. I know they're in a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we'll see them again. And those three sentences mm-hmm. is what really grounded us and gave us hope.
Mm-hmm.
And for an 11-year-old to say those three things to me is just incredible.
Right.
She, at that age, you want to be normal. That's the whole thing, is you really want to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And she's continued skating. She skated like that next day. We had her on the ice, because she would say that was the one time where she felt like normal, and she forgot about things right. in some sense. But then 3 days after, she was scheduled to go to a camp with Connor for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And they had been talking about it, because he had gone for several years and he was so thrilled and excited to have her go. And so I sent her. We decided to have her go to the camp mm-hmm. and Camp Longhorn in Texas. And she had a wonderful time and was able to just have some fun while I was home in the middle of the muck mm-hmm. and having to prepare a funeral, a celebration of life for two people and, you know, your 15-year-old son. And how do you do that?
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Now, while she had a good time, was that time more difficult for you, given that, you know, you're alone and now you're alone with your own thoughts?
Well, I wasn't alone, actually. Okay. I was very fortunate, and I had my aunt who I accepted the Lord with. She flew out and came for a week. I think she was the first week, along with my mom, and she and my brother Mike. They came in the first few days, and then my other aunt came for another week, and then my sister-in-law Leslie, she came. And so for the first 3 weeks until the celebration of life, I was with people, which was really important. And then it was after the celebration of life, you know, 2 days later, when everybody leaves, mm-hmm. then you're alone.
That's when,
and
yes.
then you're alone.
Yes.
Yeah.
So If we could maybe fast forward a little bit and maybe ask about your relationship with your dad.
So my dad at that time, so my dad had gone from this really amazing, adventurous man who loved taking people on adventures, and they were kind of outrageous. And I talk about those in King here. They're really kind of fun. And some of my favorites were, you know, we took our Harleys to Sturgis, South Dakota, to the motorcycle rally. He climbed the Matterhorn. He went around the world in 26 days on the Concorde, which was a supersonic jet. Wow. And probably one of my favorites was he once took a date from on a private jet from San Francisco to Los Angeles so they could have dinner on the Goodyear blimp flying over LA on the night lights.
Wow.
Okay.
So
then.
I know. It's like a world that, you know, most people, you don't,
wow.
I don't know. He didn't like things. He wasn't really about a lot of money or things. Mm-hmm. But so he was adventurous, and I had done so many things, snow skied with him and hot air ballooned with him.
Can I ask, did your father and husband share this passion for aviation? Did they fly to?
So they did. It was kind of interesting. Pat had pulled out of my dad, I would say, the stuff my dad loved as a youth. My dad loved fast cars, right? And Pat, they talked fast cars and, you know, switch things. They loved firing weapons. And so they had, you know, that as a commonality. And then they flew. So they loved talking about the flying aspect. So, you know, together they got to kind of unite on that front, which was kind of neat to see. And Pat did not fly because of my dad, though.
Okay.
That was very clear.
Yes. So how was the relationship between the two of them, and how did your dad take it after he passed?
So my dad does not do well with death. Mm-hmm. And that was something that was very hard for him. And really at that time, what had happened is my dad had a series. So my dad went from this multimillionaire, you know, successful businessman, and he had a series of losses, and that being one of them. And so he got addicted to Oxycontin and oxycodone, which is a narcotic and addictive. And so he was sleeping 21, 22 hours a day and living in what we called the Bat Cave. It was his bedroom, which was all dark with blackout shades and that he never opened. And Pat couldn't handle that well. He was, hey, just stop that, and didn't like what he was seeing. And as a result, actually, my dad made some statements to him that weren't very nice. And so Pat and my dad hadn't really talked in a while. And so it was really hard for my father when they both died. He came out for the celebration of life. He was 15 minutes late because he was never on time for anything.
I kind of know what that's like.
I know. Actually, he lived on King Standard Time is what we called it.
Okay.
Which was 1 to 2 hours
yes,
late.
Yes.
I've worked very hard to be just 5 minutes late.
Yeah. Well, we have some Michael Standard Time over here as well, so we get it.
Okay. Kindred spirits, high five.
Yes, yes, yes. So if I can ask, if we can maybe reverse a little bit and maybe tell us about your dad being on top. What was that like? And tell us a little bit about his career and how he got there.
Okay, so he was self-made, and I did not grow. I grew up in a, you know, kind of an average middle class, maybe sort of family. He did not have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But he started getting successful in real estate development, and then he moved to venture capital, took one company public, and he sold two other companies. So he really did really well financially. But he wasn't about things. He really had very little things, and mm-hmm. things weren't important to him in his life, which is unusual for people who right. have made an amount of money. But he really had no need for God. That was the problem is he had no need for God. And he once said, I have I have more money than God. And if I lost half my money, I would still be rich.
Wow.
And it's like, okay, wow. That's so he kind of almost in some sense, I say he developed a little bit of a God complex. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
In the book, you talk about how he lost 97% of his wealth.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. In 2007, in a very fast slide, he ignored really everybody around him with his investment style, whether it be his kids, whether his accountant, his attorneys, mm-hmm. and he really kind of was addicted to the deal back then, and addicted to making more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And he wanted, you know, to make so much money, and not again for the money to be able to, you know, to have it and to spend it. It was mm-hmm. just kind of the thrill of victory,
right?
As an athlete, it was yes. that addiction. It yes. was that high that he was looking for. And then he lost. And then in 2007, very quickly, he lost almost all of it. Mm-hmm. But he still had, you know, enough to live. Mm-hmm. He just couldn't quite do as many things as he wanted to, you know, whenever he wanted to, let's say.
There's a saying, a man is rich or poor in who he is, not what he has.
That's good.
And it seems that, you know, he was a great dad, though. Am I miscalculating?
You know, in many ways, yes. You know what? He's a great dad. He was my dad. He's the dad that God gave me.
Yes.
My parents divorced when I was 15.
Okay.
So, that was really difficult for me because you know, he left the house then. And mm-hmm. so he wasn't there. So he couldn't control me. He didn't have a huge influence at that time, which, you know, wasn't great. And then what happened too is he really, he started becoming more of a hermit in some ways. Mm-hmm. He did his really fun adventures that he got to include us on. So we got to go snow skiing or hot air ballooning. So that was super fun. But what he didn't know how to do is a lot of the day in and day out mm-hmm. stuff, mm-hmm. the simple pleasures in life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He was all about the really big things.
Right.
And so he wanted to hear if, you know, we went to nationals and how we did. He wanted to do hear about those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So my dad, he tried to come to events, but he missed most of them, or lots of them, I should say. But he did come to some events and it was just hard. The last 10 years were very difficult because he really changed with the OxyContin. Mm-hmm. And the oxycodone. He mm-hmm. he became someone totally different than who I grew up with and who raised me.
Right. And I know that as years went by, your dad actually remarried.
Yes,
and
he did.
You gained a stepmom. Tell us a little bit about that.
So Debbie was amazing. I always say she was just so incredibly beautiful and very kind. And she just doted all over him and he adored her. And they had a really, you know, a great, what I thought was a, you know, good relationship for a long time, for maybe 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then at the time where my dad got addicted, she also did. And so together, it was a pretty bad spiral of both of them living in the home in their addicted drug state and living in their bedrooms and missing life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that component, again, was so hard to understand and so hard to see when somebody loved life and she loved painting and she loved her grandchildren and she loved her daughter. Mm-hmm. And so you had all of that component and yet then wasn't available for a lot of years.
Right. And I know in the book you talk about Debbie lost her life due to addiction.
It was a combination of things. Actually, she, you know, we're not real sure actually how, but she passed away suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
Whether she had lung issues and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she was 20 years younger than my dad. So the deal was she was supposed to change my dad's diapers when he was older.
Right.
My dad talked about that.
Right.
That was the deal, you know, is she was going to be there and do that. And so she did pass away suddenly. And that was a huge loss for my dad, when that all for all of us that nobody expected.
Okay, so a lot has happened here, right? And
yes.
We've now got a better picture of your father. How was he able now to answer to all the things that had transpired in his life, right? So now you had this, you have your father here, he's regressed to a state that you don't necessarily recognize. What happened from here?
So he, you know, he didn't know where to go really with the loss of his wife. He, as I said earlier, didn't like death, right? Mm-hmm. And so he continued to stay in bed for 24 hours a day. And then at that point, my brothers, we kind of said, you know, we need to get a helper for him. We need to get, you know, somebody to help feed him, right? And to manage his pain pills. And so we got Beth Ann, who was just wonderful. She was such a godsend. And she started decreasing his pain pills and started feeding him good food. And so he started improving and getting up earlier. And she would plan events for him with the grandkids, you know, volleyball games, football games, hockey, you know, that kind of thing, and dinners at my brother's house. So that began to help him be able to have a little bit of a life and build some stories and remembrances for the grandchildren, because he had, gosh, 8-10 grandchildren, you know, at the time. And so they were worth, you know, for us, we thought they were worth living for.
Mm-hmm. So, in your Christian walk and watching your dad go through what he was going through, did you attempt to witness to him? Did you talk to him about the Bible? Did he have a relationship with God at all?
So he had no relationship with God. I had attempted many, many times over the years. I had asked him to church when I'd come into town. My brothers had asked him to church to come into town. And finally, one day he said yes. So that's the whole thing. It's like, don't give up on people. You know, I talk about that in King here. Don't give up, because, you know, after for me praying for 35 years, for my brothers asking, you know, week and week, for him to go to church, and he finally said yes and went to church with them.
Wow. You know, it listening to your story with your dad is so familiar to me, you know, because I grew up, you know, my family were strong Christians and my dad didn't go to the church with us, but yet he knew the Bible. And when I remember the day that he passed away, my father was shot and killed. And he had just promised my mom, you know, I'm going to go to church, you know. So I remember I could see his suit hanging in the dining room. You know, she had gotten his suit out, had it hanging, had pressed his shirt. And before that day ended, he was gone. So it's the similarities in some of your story are so, you know, it just touches me.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That is so tough. And in an instant, our life can change in an instant.
Absolutely.
You know, we
Absolutely.
Think we have our plans, just like my dad thought he had his plans.
Right.
And his plans changed, you know. Mm-hmm.
So when did he actually then receive Christ? When did he accept Christ?
Dad was 82 years old and really had never gone to church. And we had asked several times, my brothers and I, over the years, multiple times. But finally, after the death of his wife, he ended up agreeing to go to church with my brother. And so there, when he went to church, in the second row was what I consider an angel. Mm. His name was Michael. So Michael, angel,
wow,
get it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And he would worship the Lord with his whole body, his hands raised and going back and forth singing at a pretty conservative church. And my dad was inexplicably drawn to him.
Wow.
And so he would call my brother in the middle of the week and say, "Hey, are you going to church this week? Because I want to go and I want to get there early so I can sit behind Michael, my friend."
Oh, wow.
And again, remember, my dad was never early for anything in his life. And so, so he was drawn to Michael. And so my brother felt it was time to ask my dad if he wanted to pray to receive Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so he was bold and asked him. And my dad said no. So the next week at church, my brother asked Michael, he said, "Michael, can you please talk to my dad about Jesus? He really likes you. And so I think it'd be really great if you could talk to him about Jesus." And Michael looked at my brother and said, "God's got your dad in his hands. God's got your dad in his hands." So who says that? Like most people would say, "Sure, let me talk to your dad about Jesus."
That's right. That's right.
Right? So for me, I was like, wow, that was an angel. Mm-hmm. And so we were, my James, I had gotten remarried and the year before, and my dad really liked my husband, James. He was a successful businessman, mm-hmm. and he had also lost his wife suddenly. Wow. And so he knew my dad's pain and he understood what it was like to have guilt when you lose somebody prematurely and feel like you could have done more. Mm-hmm. And so we were going out to see my dad for his 82nd birthday. And I looked at my husband and I said, you need to share Jesus and talk to my dad about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I don't even know if, you know, we're going to be alone and have that chance." And so when we were in California and Shannon needed to ice skate, so which left James alone with my dad potentially. So James decided to do a Bible study in the kitchen. Mm. Now, remember, my dad didn't often get up until 1 or 2 in the afternoon. Right. So who knows? But he did that day, and he came in and James invited him, you know, to have breakfast with him and asked if he had ever read the Bible. And my dad said, no, he had never read the Bible. And so they began to talk, and James listened and asked questions and talked about his wife. And dad talked about his wife. And again, you know, usually my dad would say, "Well, you don't understand. You don't understand what it feels like to lose my wife." Mm-hmm. But he couldn't say that to James because James understood his pain. And then as they talked, James said, "You know, Chuck, if you were to die today and go to heaven and be at the pearly gates and they said, 'Why should we let you in?' Mm-hmm. What would you say?" And my dad said, "I'd say I've been a good person." Well, James said, but, you know, God's standard is perfection in heaven, and we've all sinned and fall short and missed the mark. Have you ever told a lie, Chuck?" And my dad said, "Well, yeah."
Yeah,
I know. So I put it.
I know. And that's a good example, Chuck. That's a good example of the sin that separates us from God. And so he began to share about Jesus and how Jesus died for us on the cross. So because of him, if we believe in him and receive him, truly receive him, then we can have forgiveness of our sins and we can have everlasting life with God. And so he asked my dad, "Do you want to pray to receive Jesus?" And my dad didn't answer. So they kept talking. James kept talking. And then ultimately he asked him a second time and said, "Chuck, would you like to pray and ask Jesus to forgive you of your sins mm-hmm. and to come into your life?" And my dad said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. So he was bold. He was bold. And I loved that boldness. Mm-hmm. And they prayed, and my dad prayed, you know, "Dear Jesus, forgive me of my sins, come into my life and let me live a life that pleases you." Mm-hmm. And gave himself at age 82, addicted to opioids, addicted to Oxycontin. He did say that prayer, which I was just totally thrilled about.
Right. So after your dad accepts Christ, what is his walk like after that?
So, you know, I think we think that we would like my dad to go to church and just come home and say, "Wow, I was really motivated and moved by that speaker. Mm-hmm. He talked about this and this and this." Well, this was an 82-year-old man who had never attended church, right? And didn't talk about feelings or interpersonal things.
Right.
Okay. So we had to look at his life and go, okay, was there any change? Okay. And I believe there was, because he would start going to, he would started going repeatedly to church, and he would go all by himself. So that meant he had to get up early, right, out of bed, get dressed, get in his car, drive to church, which was a little scary because, you know, there were some extra dents and markings on that car that kind of worried me later on. I'm like, ooh, and go to church all by himself. Beth Ann, his caretaker, would find his Bible on his bed, that James that and Shannon and I had gotten him, and they'd find, you know, the Bible would be moved, so we knew he was reading the Bible. And so that was really the change that we saw. There wasn't, you know, unfortunately, we weren't around James. We went back to New Mexico, so we weren't there to mentor. And I think that would be the difference is, you know, I wish I could have brought somebody into his life to really teach him how to walk with God now, because he didn't know what that looked like. You know, he may have seen it in us, but that's still different.
Well, getting up and going to church by yourself and getting there on time and doing that consistently, that's a good portion of it, right?
It showed that there was change.
That's right.
To me, it showed that, because again, when you have the standard of he didn't used to get up until 1 or 2 in the afternoon,
right,
and really never get dressed, right, then all of a sudden now he's made the effort himself to go to church and to hear. So that showed desire, that showed wanting.
Now, what would you say to someone who may be listening, who has a significant person in their life, whether they are a family member, friend, who is addicted to opioids or some other kind of drug?
I would say you are not alone. You are not alone. Don't give up on them. Keep praying. And of course, get other people to pray. But be bold and be proactive. Don't just ignore it and think that it's going to go away. Get help. You can go to the addictioncenter.com and get help. You can join Naranon meetings for family members. You can do an intervention. You can talk to their doctors. And I know with HEPA laws, you can't say a lot, but you can still talk to doctors and give them information. Sometimes there's tough love that's needed, but don't give up on them. Just don't give up.
Right.
Keep being active.
So, Trish, shortly after, not long after your dad accepted Christ into his heart, something tragic happened again in your life. Can you maybe walk us through that?
Yeah. So, maybe 4 months later, I got a call from my sister-in-law that my dad had taken his life. With the opioids. So he became a statistic, an opioid suicide statistic. That just, you know, it's not finishing well. I think it made me so mad because here I had this amazing father who had all these great Chuckisms, you know, right? I have those. If you go to my website, you can download those Chuckisms. And so he had all those great sayings. And then he just didn't finish well. But I do believe that there was a peace that came for him, as a result, you know, because he knew where he was going. He knew where he was going. It just was, to me, a tragic way to end your life and affect so many people around him.
Right.
That's the aspect that he didn't realize is how many people he affected and needed and who loved him.
It's interesting because on our last show, we spoke a little bit about suicide and church and how rampant it really is in today's society. And, you know, and now you're talking about your dad and how he accepted Christ. And then a few months later, he commits, you know, suicide as well. Is there something that that you would say, especially to our young people, even when it comes to holding on and not giving up, and you know, there's a better way.
Yeah. You know, yes. You are not alone. This feeling that you have, which may be strong, is really temporary, and you have value. God loves you, and your family loves you, and joy can come in the morning. You don't know that there's another day where all of a sudden something can change in your life.
Right.
So it is so important that we don't follow our feelings, right? Mm. I mean, I've felt terrible. I've had loss. I've had pain. Mm-hmm. And really, put your eyes on the Lord and focus. If you can focus on Him and not on your circumstances, mm-hmm. and focus on His promises. Mm. Because you have so many people that you can affect in life in a positive way. Mm-hmm. So you may have a temporary feeling. Don't listen to that lie. Listen to truth, God's truth, the truth that God loves you. Mm-hmm. And He wants you to live a life here on earth that's powerful and effective. And you'll get through this time. Just stay there, stay with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And get help. Or also get help. Tell somebody. Tell a counselor. Get some counseling. You know, don't do this alone. We need people within the body of Christ. We need people. We need to encourage each other, mm-hmm. and build each other up and strengthen each other. Mm-hmm.
Just listening to your strength is just pretty unbelievable. Having lost your husband, your son, your stepmom, your dad. And then you still have this strength and this courage. As I was saying earlier, you know, I have similar loss. I lost my dad. He was murdered. I lost my sister. I lost my mom.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And, you know, people would ask, you know, how do you stay so strong? But I know for me, you know, it was my relationship with God.
Yep.
It was that personal relationship that pushed me through. And I'm not saying that it was easy, because I broke each time. I broke.
Yep.
And
yep.
there was so much bitterness and hatred that I carried around for a while. But then I was able to release that, right?
Wow.
And I was able to, you know, trust God and know that through Him, you know, I could overcome anything, right? So to hear you talk and hear, you know, your strength, it's pretty remarkable. And I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. It really was the Lord. I mean, there were, like you, what an amazing story that you have. And we have a choice. We have mm-hmm. a choice in how we're going to respond to that difficult time. And I had there were so many days, day after day, where I was running on the track, keeled over then, mm-hmm. and on my knees, just sobbing mm-hmm. with a guttural down to my core. But staying strong, staying focused on God and mm-hmm. trusting Him through that, you know, I got through that type of pain. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I don't cry and I still,
absolutely.
You know, have, you know,
yes.
the memories
still
and
have the moments
and
yes.
the heartache. Yes, yes, I still have those moments.
Mm-hmm.
But I trust the Lord, and I know He heard me, mm-hmm. and I know He loves me.
Yes.
And I cling to that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Would you give me one of your favorite Chuckisms?
Oh my gosh, there are so many.
Give us a few then. Give us a few.
Okay. Yeah. So the one that I think probably impacted me the most, and by the way, so you can go to Trish Porter Topmiller, TOPMILLER.com, and download. And download those Chuckisms that I have, mm-hmm. lots of Chuckisms for you. But my favorite one was when I was competing at the state championships in high school in the high jump, he gave me a little slip of paper that he had typed out. Well, I imagine his secretary had typed out. And it said, dream, then go after that dream with sweat and commitment.
Okay,
and,
I like that.
And that, I carried that piece of paper around with me for years, and that truly motivated me.
Right.
And I loved that. I loved that. And then, let's see, I think, did you mention, I love the before marriage, keep your eyes open, and then after marriage, keep your eyes half open.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
So I think that's so applicable and true. And then you have Fords pass Cadillacs all day long. They just have to work harder. So I loved that concept of hard work and yes.
Wow.
A phenomenal story and a phenomenal person. I love the fact as well that the title of the book is King Here. Your story is so strong and you've accomplished so much. Your name could have very easily been on the front of this book, and you've chosen to put your father there. That says a lot about who you are and your character, and we are so pleased to have this conversation today.
Well, thank you. And actually, I don't know if I said that, really, King Here also has a double entendre.
Okay.
So right, it's King Here, my father answering the phone. So anybody who knew my father goes, oh my gosh, that's the perfect title, right?
Yes.
But it also means King Here, to me, the God of God, the King of Kings, is saying, hey, I'm here. Listen to me. Listen to this story. Let me empower you. Let me inspire you. Hear this story.
I love that.
So I like, for me, it's really the double entendre.
I love that.
Right.
So we want to encourage our sweet spotters. You know, this is an amazing read. It's not, you can read it in a day. It's a couple hours, actually. Yeah, yes. It is full of information, and it's a very, very interesting read. The title is King Here, Never Too Old, Too Rich, Too Anything to Meet Jesus. I love that. I love how you, never too old, too rich, or too anything to meet Jesus.
And Trish, you've helped us meet Jesus today. Testimony, your story, that of your family, and the way you embrace it. We just have been inspired today and are so grateful to have this opportunity to share with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I love just being with both of you, and may God bless you and your show. And your families.
Thank you so much. Sweet Spotters, please go out, get King Here, Trish Porter Todd Miller. It is a great read. Tell your friends. Trust me on this one. You don't want to miss out on it.
So let's end like this. Trish, you and the book are phenomenal.
Mic drop.